from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. This is New York Times columnist Charles Blow writing in the wake of the verdict that still has everyone talking. As a parent of black teenage boys, he writes, I'm left with the question, what do I tell my boys? We used to say not to run because that might make them seem suspicious. But Trayvon Martin drew suspicion because he was walking too slowly. So at what precise pace should a black man walk to avoid suspicion? What do I tell my boys now? Charles Blow in the New York Times. In the hour ahead, a conversation about race. What do we need to tell each other? Parent to child, black to white, neighbor to neighbor. Ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It's almost a week since the verdict came down. Yet why is it that we can't quit talking about it? And why is it, by the way, that we think of it as the Trayvon Martin case rather than the George Zimmerman case? Was it because it was really Trayvon Martin who was on trial? Was it because it was really Trayvon Martin who was not presumed innocent? As many have observed, Florida's Stand Your Ground law and gun laws may have made the jury's verdict inevitable. But what in turn do those laws say about the nature of our suspicions and fears in this summer of 2013? It was 50 summers ago, August of 1963, that Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. So 50 summers later, where are we? That's the question we want to explore this morning. Beyond Stand Your Ground laws, on what ground do race relations currently stand in America? Joining us for that conversation, Eva Patterson. She's president and co-founder of the Equal Justice Society, previously director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, and also co-founded the California Coalition for Civil Rights. Eva, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well, Angela Glover Blackwell, founder and chief executive officer of Policy Link, an Oakland-based nonprofit dedicated to advancing economic and social equity, and co-author of Uncommon Common Ground, Race and America's Future. Angela Glover Blackwell, good morning as well.
Good morning.
And joining us by phone this morning, Peniel Joseph. He's professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University and the author of Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Peniel Joseph, good morning as well.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks all very much for joining in this conversation this morning. Eva Patterson, Charles Blow, the columnist for the New York Times, wrote this week that the not guilty verdict was more powerful than the verdict could have been if it were guilty. Do you agree with that? And if so, what did that verdict say to you?
It said, as a black person, I'm not safe, that black youngsters aren't safe, that we have a jury system that would take a situation where a young black boy with Skittles and iced tea was walking home and is now dead, and that the person who shot him is free. In a similar situation involving a woman named Marissa Alexander in Florida, she was being attacked by her husband. She shot into the air. She got 20 years in jail. Prosecuted by the same woman, Angela Corey, who prosecuted George Zimmerman. So there's a real double standard here in America. Black folks like us think, well, things are getting better. There's a black president. But this tore the scab off the wound and made you realize that if you're black, you have a target on your back. And it was very heartbreaking. I've talked to many, many people whose hearts were just broken and who were angry. So it was a horrible reaffirmation of the fact that racism's alive and well, and we're not in post-racial America.
Do you feel you have a target on your back?
When I drove back from Mendocino over the weekend, I was there with a book group that actually Angela had invited me to. I felt all safe because I was around black women. I pulled into Cloverdale, into a gas station, and I was all of a sudden surrounded by mainly white people. And my feeling was, and I have white friends, Dave, you and I party together a lot. You're my buddy. I have nothing against white people. Some of my best friends are white people. But I was in that gas station and I was going, these white people have heard this verdict. They could say, well, she tried to rob me. I felt in danger and I had to shoot her. I felt very vulnerable in my black skin, and I felt that way for the rest of the day. I've talked with other black people who felt the same way. I've talked with Asian Americans who felt the same way after the Vincent Chin murder. You just all of a sudden feel like you're not equal, you are vulnerable, you do have a target on your back. I'm kind of over it, but I felt very, very vulnerable that day. And I can't imagine how young black men and Latino men are feeling after a man who murdered an innocent black boy is free and also has his gun back.
Angela Glover Blackwell, what are you feeling this Friday morning, 6 days after the verdict?
Well, I don't feel any different now than I did the moment I heard the verdict, that's for sure. My feeling of outrage and disappointment is not lessening. But just thinking about the question that you were asking, Eva, I don't feel like I have a target on my back. I am a wife, though, to a black man. I am the mother of a black son. I'm the grandmother of a black grandson. I'm the sister to two brothers. And I have worried about the black men that have surrounded me all my life. And that has not changed. I am as worried about my grandson as I was about my son. This notion that black men don't matter is the most disturbing thing that you can imagine as a person who wants to be in the world wishing the best for those around you. It's so unfair. It is just so unfair. And people are so ignorant to the value, the potential, the humanity of black men and boys. That's the thing that really gets me. I don't feel that I have a target on my back, but because I'm prepared to throw myself in front of all these black men and boys that I know that I am not safe.
Peniel Joseph, what's the conversation you think we need to have at week's end and on into the future?
Well, I think the Trayvon Martin case, the biggest thing that we need to do, and I've been writing about this since the verdict, is we need a national conversation on race that's connected to substantive public policy. We need leadership. We're getting some leadership right now from these activists who are on the phone, these scholars and activists and lawyers. But we need political, social, cultural leadership to have a conversation that connects to substantive public policy transformations. Because you mentioned earlier, it's the 50th anniversary of 1963, and 1963 is really a watershed year in American history. It's really the crown jewel of the heroic period of the Civil Rights Movement that occurs between the Brown decision in 1954 and the Voting Rights Act, which is passed August 6, 1965. And 63 is also the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. So what's important for us is that the March on Washington is about to be commemorated, yet 50 years after the March on Washington, we can have a tragedy like Trayvon Martin. But the March on Washington was about trying to transform American democracy, trying to confront racism, racial discrimination, white supremacy, but also trying to confront democracy's jagged edges of unemployment, imprisonment, which has turned into mass incarceration, disparate treatment, disparate racial outcomes. But at least 50 years ago, we started a national conversation. So that day, August 28, 1963, was a Wednesday, and that was the first time John F. Kennedy ever heard Martin Luther King Jr. deliver a full speech. And that 17-minute I Have a Dream speech is a speech about struggle and about democratic transformation. King says in that speech that black people are coming to D.C. to claim a check and to get a check that has been marked insufficient funds, but he says we refuse to believe that the bank of democracy is bankrupt. And he says that black and white people are going to have to struggle and go to jail together to transform democracy. So King was talking about a long-distance race. It was a marathon. And when we think about Trayvon Martin, the discussion we should be having is about racial outcomes. We're locked in a vicious cycle of colorblind racism in the United States where conservatives and liberals have declared the end of racism, and propagated a mythology of post-racial America, and they say racial equality is a fact and ignore racial disparities when it comes to mass incarceration, health care, housing, unemployment. So this is the time to confront that right now. So Trayvon, who really is reminiscent of Emmett Till, the young black boy who was murdered in 1955 in Money, Mississippi, and whose body was found in the Tallahatchie River with a 125-pound cotton gin fan belt tied around his neck, Emmett Till's body was shown in Jet magazine in 1955, and that really transformed race relations in America because so many people saw what the impact of white supremacy was on ordinary American citizens. Trayvon Martin has shown us the same thing, and now we have to have a conversation that's tied to public policy, and not just public policy with the criminal justice system, but public policy in every single facet of American life. And we need presidential leadership here, too. It's been very disappointing not to hear from the President of the United States. In 2013, we shouldn't live in a country where we need a white president to show bold and effective leadership on race matters.
We shouldn't live
in a country where we need John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson to have a conversation about race.
I want to come back to the question of leadership because it's such an interesting one with our first black president in a moment. But I want to just go a little bit deeper into something that you said, Peniel Joseph, and ask Eva Patterson and Angela Glover Blackwell to comment on this. Eva, first, Peniel Joseph said a moment ago that the tragedy of Trayvon Martin, obviously a tragedy in the loss of a human life and for his family. But can you tell me something more about what the tragedy is?
The tragedy is that there are Trayvon Martins all over the country whose names don't get lifted up. I think Sean Bell in New York, Amadou Diallo, all kinds of people who are shot because they're black. On a level kind of riffing off what Angela said, there's just the mistreatment of black men, walking while black, driving while black. There are certain assumptions that people in society have about black men that were played out in the most tragic way with the Trayvon Martin murder. There is an assumption that a young black boy out at night was somehow dangerous. If you listen to that one juror who was on with Anderson Cooper, she totally bought the defense's point of view that, oh, he wasn't racially profiled. He was just profiled because there had been dangerous people in that neighborhood. Now, think of all the mass murderers in our society. They're generally white men, but we don't have this fear of all white men because you have the crazy Newtown and Aurora folks. So I think what the Trayvon Martin situation lifted up was a notion, as Angela was saying, of how badly black and Hispanic men are treated in society. We do some work with social science about implicit bias and people acting on stereotypes. The stereotypical view that most people have about black men and Latino men is that they are dangerous, aggressive, and should be watched.
And is there a direct connection then, Angela Glover Blackwell, and then back to you, Peniel Joseph, in that suspicion and fear? Is the tragedy that those suspicions and fears are still alive and well, and that there's a direct connection then between those suspicions and fears and public policy and where we have not advanced in terms of economic equity?
Yes, there's a connection. The tragedy is twofold, and it's important to call them both out. And Eva called out the one that we can never forget. The tragedy in the loss of a life senselessly based on racial bias and unaddressed. That is a huge tragedy. And the tragedy that in 2013, 50 years after the moment in the sun for this country, the March on Washington and the civil rights legislation that followed, 50 years on, so little has changed for the black population. And now we have a huge Latino population that has come into the same circumstance. Huge tragedy. I've just got to point out that when that March on Washington was about education, employment, poverty, housing, and those demands have not been met, black people in this country still are disproportionately poor. Mm-hmm. 27% black people living below the poverty level. almost three, probably more than three times the poverty level for mm-hmm. white people.
Exactly.
At going to segregated schools that are failing black children, over 76% of black children in this country go to schools that are 50% or more other children of color. And most of those schools are failing them. The unemployment rate for black people remains twice that for white people. It was that in 1963, mm-hmm. and it is that today. That is a tragedy that plays out every day across this country. Black people individually, many black people as individuals, can point to progress. We have a black person in the White House. You can't deny that some black people have made extraordinary progress. But as a group, I am sorry, black people are not better off. That is the tragedy that gets called to mind for black people in this country when you have a tragedy like what happened to Trayvon.
And Peniel Joseph, back now to this question of leadership and the kind of leadership that we need to have. You were very critical in a piece you wrote recently about President Obama and said that he was, in a way, guilty of a kind of moral cowardice by not stepping forward, not leading in this moment. What do you want him to say in this conversation?
Well, I think black people all over the world were extraordinarily proud after the 2008 election. And so I think Obama has been given a wide berth. There's an understanding that there's been right-wing and conservative criticism of him, that some of his administrative policies have not objectively been criticized. He's been criticized because he's a black man, and he's tried to do policies that are connected more to the great society than to the undermining of government that many conservatives would want. That being said, there's also been too wide of a berth given to Barack Obama by the entire mainstream African-American community. And what I mean by that is that everybody from the NAACP to talking heads and pundits on cable news have really been loath to criticize the president. And part of that is because within the African-American community, if you do criticize the president, a lot of times you're going to be vilified and demonized for doing that. And what's important at this point is that even the protests against the death of Trayvon Martin, they haven't zeroed in on the very symbol of American democracy and the commander-in-chief, which is the president of the United States. So President Obama has gone on record and said he's not president of black America. To that I reply, fine, but black Americans are actually American citizens, whether the president wants to acknowledge that or not, or whether other Americans want to acknowledge that or not. So just because we have the first black president doesn't mean that we abdicate our roles as citizens. And all citizens in this plural democracy are advocating on their behalf. So black people, yes, they want a black agenda. People who are gay and lesbian want a pro-gay and lesbian agenda. There's nothing wrong with that. That's our democracy. But the president has really not had to really confront that black agenda because he served as a de facto civil rights leader, unfortunately. There's a mythology around President Obama as if he's Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King boldly spoke truth to power and was a human rights activist and an anti-war activist and a peace activist. He never ran for elected office. So the leadership he should show is very similar to the leadership that John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson showed. John Kennedy does a speech that addresses the entire nation June 11th, 1963, in the context of crises that are happening in Birmingham and all over the country, and says that this nation, for all its hopes and all its boasts, will not be free until all its citizens are free. And Kennedy pointedly discusses slavery and says that anybody who's talking about delay, there's already been a century of delay, and that the heirs of former slaves are still not yet free. And Kennedy also acknowledges the fact that there are millions of Americans of goodwill who are serving as leaders and civic and political leaders who are trying to transform American race relations, but he connects racial equality to the future of American democracy. Lyndon Johnson does the same thing, most memorably March 15, 1965, in the middle of the Selma demonstrations where Congressman John Lewis's skull is fractured. Lyndon Johnson, in a joint address to Congress, he says that we shall overcome, but he compares the civil rights demonstrators in Selma to the revolutionary patriots of the American Revolution who were fighting battles in Lexington and Concord, and he says the future of American democracy is tied into voting rights and racial equality for African Americans.
Let me hold you there, because Eva Patterson is eager to join in on this point. Eva?
I wanted to combine points that Peniel and Angela made, and there's this cognitive dissonance in America. All the horrifying statistics that Angela set out are happening against this backdrop of a Supreme Court that says we're going to gut the Voting Rights Act because basically racism's over, everything's great. You've got Antonin Scalia saying that the Voting Rights Act amounts to racial entitlement. You've got people who say, oh, you black people and Latinos, stop complaining. You have a black president, everything's good. You've got the elimination of race-conscious admissions. When Angela and I went to Bolt, in my entering class, there were 30 black students. After the elimination of affirmative action, there was one black student. One of the ways that black people and Latinos and others lift ourselves up is through economic progress. Getting a JD, becoming a lawyer, that allows your family to have more economic viability. So we have worsening conditions for African Americans and Latinos against this national narrative that there's a black president, that we're post-racial, that we don't need civil rights acts. So there's a double whammy.
Do you agree with Peniel Joseph that black president, our black president, should be doing more to lead this conversation?
These comments are going to be going out all across the nation. I'm going, oh, my God, everyone's going to hear me saying what I'm about to say. But yes, I do. I believe that. And I understand the politics of it because he thinks he's going to be vilified if he pursues a black agenda. But there's been a black agenda an immigration agenda that's allowed the Dreamers to stay in the country. He has pursued a marriage equality agenda for LGBT people. And I think it's important for him to explicitly pursue a black agenda. I don't want to criticize the brother. We're so happy that he's there. I think Peniel's exactly right. And I'm one of the people who hasn't been speaking up. If he were a white Democrat, I'd be all over him. Hmm. But you don't want to be on him because he's being attacked in so many ways. But our silence allows bad things to keep going on. I wish he would be more explicitly pushing a black agenda. I understand why he isn't, but it's tragic.
We're going to continue our conversation in a moment. We're going to take a short break in just a minute, and we want to include you in our conversation this morning. Is there something more that you think President Obama should be doing? Is there something more you think you should be doing? What is the conversation that we all need to have? What is the conversation that you've had at your dinner table this week or at the water cooler at work? What is it that we need to talk about in terms of the state of race in America in the summer of 2013, some 50 years after Martin Luther King gave his speech in August of 1963 in Washington, D.C.? You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786 is our number. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website as well. Some comments coming in from our website and Facebook page already. I'm so troubled by this. I'm inclined to believe that Zimmerman's action was murder rather than self-defense. It is what I think has happened, but it's just a hunch. The trouble is that it seems that there's no solid evidence. The jury needs to return a verdict in a way that goes beyond that. Sadly, the young man died without a witness, and I'm very sad about that. We will continue our conversation again in just a moment, 866-733-6786. Our phone lines are already full. We will take your calls when we return. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website. What is the conversation we need to have about race in America in this, the summer of 2013? I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, race in the summer of 2013, 50 years after the March on Washington. Our guests include Peniel Joseph, professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University, Angela Glover Blackwell, founder and chief executive officer of Policy Link, and Eva Patterson, president and co-founder of the Equal Justice Society. Angela Glover Blackwell, you wanted to weigh in on the question of presidential leadership as well.
presidential leadership is always required and should always be demanded. I don't think that anybody who takes the office of president of the United States should expect not to be pushed. You put yourself there as the leader to lead forward, and you should expect that people have high expectations. I think the black community was guilty of giving President Clinton a huge pass, and I was always critical of that, wondering why we were accepting black women on welfare, just getting pushed into a situation that was unfair to them, why we let him get away with three strikes and you're out. I think that we should always think about what the policy goals are that we need and never shy away of demanding presidential leadership, this president or any president. I also think that we have to call out the circumstance that is unacceptable right now with a Congress that will not move, mm-hmm. will not let anything happen. And I'm tired of hearing that called gridlock and referring to both sides being unable. We have to call out that it has been the Republican Party that has made it very difficult for us to move forward. People enter that conversation always as if the Democrats and the Republicans just won't get along. That's not what's going on. Democrats have tried in many ways. Sometimes they have compromised more than I have wanted to see. And so we need to call that out at the same time. But I want to spend a moment talking about how things are fundamentally different in 2013 than they were in 1963. We are rapidly becoming a nation in which the majority are people of color. This was not true in 1963. Probably more than 85-90% of the country was white. Now, barely more than 50% of children are white. Almost 47% of all children in this country are of color. I think that we need to step up and put the challenges of the nation in a different context. Black people are not the only ones that are making up people of color now. Latinos, Asians, Native American population is still here and still suffering. We're in a different context, but we're not acknowledging it, either from the standpoint of people of color in terms of what we represent in terms of the future, or white America understanding that if people of color don't thrive, America does not thrive.
And that's part of the conversation that ought to be had as well, beyond this particular tragic moment. It's coming to an understanding of that we all can only thrive if each one of us thrives. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Bob starts us out in Mill Valley this morning. Bob, go ahead.
Good morning. I would like to suggest a ameliorating effect that may be coloring our argument, and that it may not be as bad as we will hear from the evidence. I think it's more a case of not truth to power as it is truth to stupid, and maybe the squeaky wheel metaphor comes into play here, because a very vocal, violently anti-civil anything is making far more noise, way out of proportion to a larger change in the cultural dynamics that we just do not see. And my example for that would be the 2008 election, where the sleeping giant awoke and put our president into office, unexpected from most quarters. So although I'm in agreement with the substance of the arguments being made this morning, I would suggest it may not be as bad as we first it appears to be.
Okay, Bob, thank you. Thanks for getting us started in our conversation this morning. Here's some other comments coming in this morning. Beth writes, where are the Al Sharptons and Eric Holders and the black community at large? Where are they marching to demand something to be done? People need to take back their communities and stop looking outside for someone to blame. Joanne writes, it seems to me that both Zimmerman and Trayvon were thinking in stereotypes. Zimmerman thought, damn black kid in my neighborhood. Trayvon thought, damn cracker following me. Is there bilateral racism? How do you react to that, Eva Patterson?
The only problem was Trayvon Martin didn't have a gun. And George Zimmerman, they could have fussed and hollered at each other. And what are you doing here? And why are you here? And I belong here. And then they could have talked and it could have gone on. But Mr. Zimmerman had a gun and shot Mr. Martin. And so there's not an equivalency.
Regarding the first comment, Reverend Al Sharpton has organized with others to have a 50th reunion of the March on Washington on August 28th. And so he is acting. He is marching. And Eric Holder, our attorney general at the NAACP convention, made really strong remarks about how he's reacted to what has happened. So we shouldn't feel that black leaders all across the country from many different standpoints are not moving forward. Part of our problem now is that unless you happen to know these things, unless you're hooked in to that particular cable station, you don't know what's happening in America. It is so sad that we don't have a way for people to have to know what the facts are.
Peniel Joseph, Angela was making the point a moment ago, too, about the question of gridlock. And you've talked about how we need to make progress in terms of policy. And you've written that the protests are fine, but we need to make progress in terms of policy. So what's that next step? What do you see as being the next feasible, logical step that could be taken?
Well, the heroic period of the civil rights movement was marked by social movements that were both in and outside of mainstream American politics. So I think back now to 1964 and Fannie Lou Hamer, who was the heroic SNCC activist, who was a sharecropper from Ruleville, Mississippi, and testifying live before the Credentials Committee about how she was beaten and brutalized, and asking that, is this America where a black woman, a mother, can be brutalized and have her ribs broken for trying to register to vote in Mississippi? And the answer was yes. That was America in 1964. So the heart of the problem that we're at now is connected to race and democracy, like it has always been historically. This country is founded on racial slavery, and in the aftermath of Fannie Lou Hamer's testimony, we get a Civil Rights Act, we get a Voting Rights Act, but those things haven't been enough to transform inequality. So, for instance, in 1986 and 1988, the Congress passed crime bills that have really subjugated black men and women to the drug war. And those crime bills didn't mention race. They just made different punitive policies for those who sell crack cocaine instead of those who sell powdered cocaine. So you can have colorblind racism inscribed into the law, and you no longer need to say colored or white public signs in restrooms or theaters or bathrooms. It's the outcomes that we need to look at. And so the next step is to have a movement that can actually pressure the United States Congress, that can actually pressure Barack Obama, who's extraordinarily thin-skinned to criticism, and pressure the United States Senate and even the Supreme Court to think about racial outcomes, because the new racism is about racial outcomes. And even right now, one of the callers said things may not be as bad as we think. I would disagree empirically. Right now in America, there's 43 million black people. Only 1.6% make $200,000 a year or more. 28% live below the poverty line. Another 27% make under $35,000 a year. Black people, since slavery, have not recovered, let alone the 50 years since the Jim Crow period. And this is something that, unless we confront in an open and honest way, we're going to have millions of white Americans who think the only reason why black men are in jail, why black people don't make it, is because they're too lazy, too disinterested, too unintelligent to pursue the American dream, instead of understanding that the American dream has been inscribed with white privilege and institutional racism that allows for Hurricane Katrina, that allows for Oscar Grant, that allows for the dehumanization of Trayvon Martin to turn him from a victim into a criminal. The reason why we have poverty and urban ghettos 50 years after the March on Washington is because this is part and parcel of the way in which American democracy works, even though people like Fannie Lou Hamer and Martin King were trying to transform this system so democracy was multiracial, multicultural, and promoting racial equality.
Let's hear more from our callers, Richard in Penn Grove. Richard, go ahead.
Thanks for the program. So, folks, I'm this whole situation is deeply disturbing to me and to my family. I am an older Anglo man. My grandchildren are half Mexican, and their skin tone, visually, they'll never be treated for anything but being Latino. my nephew and niece are African-American half and are both dark-skinned enough to be treated for nothing other than their on appearance, African-American. Our entire family is cringing at the fact and is fearful of the fact that this kind of thing still exists. But I'm taken aback a little bit when I hear, and I also heard the lady, and forgive me, I didn't catch your name, that you understand the politics as far as talking against or giving President Obama some guano about this. I don't know that any of us can know how it is and what the politics actually are, seeing as how he is our first black president. He's also done an extraordinary and amazing job with and in a time that is unprecedented. When he was handed basically a pile of guano by our former administration. So I have a little bit of trouble laying so much of the blame as far as leadership goes and so on. I wish we could talk more about community and togetherness leadership. I wish we could talk more about reaching across rather than calling each other by the color of our skin. I wish we could talk more about Americans and being Americans, and that the people who are treating, especially people like George Zimmerman and the people who pass laws like this, Stand Your Ground laws, how un-American that is, and how un-American any hateful and despicable community misunderstanding of our core togetherness is.
Richard, thank you. Thank you. Eva Patterson.
A couple of points. Thank you for your comment. Most of us have had some sadness about the fact that President Obama hasn't pushed an explicit black agenda, but we've spent very little time and energy jamming him up or giving him a hard time because we know the circumstances under which he is governing. But I agree with Angela and Peniel in that it's our duty as citizens to say we wish he would do more, and I think that that's correct. In terms of reaching across the racial gulf, there's going to be a local celebration of the March on Washington at the Oaken Museum on August 28th. You can go to www.equaljusticesociety.org. It's been endorsed by people all races, LGBT, Jewish folks, Muslims. So we will be coming together to work. Also, people are advocating that the Department of Justice prosecute George Zimmerman for civil rights violations. My good friend Howard Moore suggests that we ask Eric Holder to enforce the Matthew Shepard, James Byrd Hate Crimes Act, which allows the Justice Department to go after people who feel that they've violated their civil rights if the state court has not acted appropriately. The last thing I'll say is I totally agree with Mr. Joseph about outcomes. We have a constitutional standard that says the only way you can show that the Constitution's protections against equal protection violations has been violated is to show that the violations were intentional. Most people don't think they're racist. We much more want to look at outcomes. So I completely look to Mr. Joseph for support on this, and we are pushing that the United States Supreme Court change this standard. So I think looking at outcomes is a very important way of analyzing racial discrimination.
And to Ola in Houston. Ola, go ahead. Are you with us, Ola, in Houston? Nope. We will come back and see if we can get you later. Let me read a couple of comments coming in. Lori writes this from Davis. Let me turn the discussion around a bit. Granted, there is racism in our country today, which needs to be addressed, and I am not excusing Zimmerman's actions, but I am suggesting that the behavior of the victim can change the outcome. I'm white, female, 50 years old, not a typical suspect. However, when I'm near a policeman, I become polite and deferential. I'm not saying that's right, but I'm suggesting that all people might be better off if we became more subservient around people with guns.
George Zimmerman was not a policeman. George Zimmerman was not a policeman. He was a person jumped out of his car, started chasing this young guy down the street who was doing nothing but walking down, drinking his iced tea. No reason why he should have been subservient. Every reason why he should have felt threatened. I want to go to the other question, though, and comment on leadership. We really do need to acknowledge that we need leadership at every level. And the communities need to really show the kind of leadership that is needed. I have to acknowledge that while we are coming together as a community, the Black community, and I think the Latino community and others are certainly joining with us, complete outrage in terms of what we see as a tragedy and a miscarriage of justice, we need to similarly come together and do what we can to stop the killing of Black and brown young men in our communities.
So
leadership is needed at every level.
And so what's the leadership level that is needed between you and me, between people who are listening, between the conversations that you have at the dinner table? What's the individual act of leadership that each person should take?
All American people need to step up to the conversation about race. All of us have something to add to that conversation. Anyone who sits at any table and allows things to be said that need to be informed by a racial consciousness, you do yourself and everyone at that table a disservice if you don't open it up.
Yeah.
We all need to have a conversation about race, and we need to know that we're going to be awkward, we're going to hurt feelings, we're going to stumble, we're going to be incompetent at it. But the more we try it, the better we'll get. I haven't finished. The other thing that we need to do is that we need to take leadership in our professional realms. I can't tell you how many times I sit in rooms. I often know that people invite me into that room because they think that I'm going to help to bring a deeper discussion around the issues they know I have real expertise, including race. But when I hit the race issue hard, I see their backs go up. People wanted me to bring that conversation in, but they wanted me to bring it in gently so that they would not be uncomfortable. Other professionals need to really bring their strong backs into that discussion. One more thing.
We
need to make sure that we all become policy advocates for the things that Dr. Joseph was talking about. America won't change until our policies change.
And Peniel Joseph, I can tell you're eager to jump in here. And if you would, though, start with Angela's last point about that we need to be uncomfortable.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the leadership is happening. I mean, at Tufts University, we're serving as one of those leaders on the East Coast through the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. And September 12th, right here at Tufts, we're going to have a national dialogue on Race Day and a Martin Luther King Jr. and Trayvon Martin commemoration and symposium. And we're starting that dialogue, but we're connecting it to public policy. We're connecting it to mass incarceration and the disparate treatment of Black defendants right here in Massachusetts. We're connecting it to ending gang violence in Boston and Mattapan. We're connecting it to poverty and dehumanization. But we're also going to bring along people who may not agree with our perspective. So this idea of feeling uncomfortable, we need to bring people of goodwill to the table so that we can meet and we can dialogue and we can come to some kind of understanding. And finally, I mean, we need to be educated. I think one of the things that Trayvon Martin has shown all of us, especially educators, is really the paucity of knowledge about the history of race in this country. The biggest thing most Americans don't realize is that America was founded on racial slavery. So the idea of slavery is something that's completely been lost. And that slavery, even after it ends formally in 1865, there's another century of formalized segregation or racial apartheid or Jim Crow. And even after the Voting Rights Act, it takes really a couple of decades for Black political power to be amassed in the South and North. And if you look at Thomas Etzel, who's been writing wonderful blogs in the New York Times about race, he wrote a recent blog about Black power in the South declining. And he's really talking about the Republican takeover of state legislatures in places like North Carolina that have diminished Black political power at the local level.
Peniel,
and the new VRA decision, the Shelby case, is only going to further diminish that. So we need to connect that conversation. And it's not just about race. I want to
just briefly, if you would, Peniel, because we have just a few moments left, and I want to get
about
in some other listener
and
comments.
Democracy.
Race and democracy,
It's a conversation about race and democracy.
Let me read you this. Robert from Berkeley writes in, "Why can't KQED move on? We've really heard all there is to hear about this case. And all we're doing is going over and over and over again.
I was thinking about this whole topic as I was driving in, and the issue of race goes on day in, day out. The Trayvon Martin case lifts it up, but there's no way to move on. You heard the statistics that Angela broke down. You heard what Peniel said. Move on, does that mean we just accept that racism is alive and well? The Trayvon Martin case is just a kind of flashpoint and just kind of illustrates what's going on all the time.
I think
it's very important for us to talk about this because it's going to go away. Newtown got us talking about gun violence and then we stopped. We can't stop talking about it. Racism is here. There are effects of it day in, day out.
What interests me, I guess, in this, though, is the number of comments that we're also getting that, for example, Sharon writes, this constant talk about having a conversation is tiring. So this is interesting to me. I mean, what is it that is tiring? What is it that we need to overcome so that it's not tiring?
I get that it's tiring. I tell you, I'm tired of it. I am tired of having to come back to the same issues again and again and again. But until I see progress, I'm not going to stop. Until our children are getting the education they deserve, until our men and boys are not unfairly incarcerated, until those who have been can come out and be welcomed into community and society and get jobs, until unemployment is not at the level that it is with our black teenagers and young people. There's so much that has to be addressed. Who's not tired of talking about the same problems over and over and over again? But we can't stop. And these people who are tired of it need to ask themselves, what would they do if their biggest problem in their lives, I don't know what it is, it might be an illness, it might be a child who has a problem, it might be a parent that's sick. What would you feel if those around you said, I'm tired of hearing about your problems. Just go deal with it yourself. You know, we got to move on and grow
up. If white people are tired of talking about race, I'm here to tell them that black people are exhausted about talking about race. If whites are tired, blacks are exhausted. And we've been exhausted for hundreds and hundreds of years, but we continue to press on until the dream of racial equality and racial and economic justice becomes a fact. So we continue to press on, and we will not ignore the difference, the yawning gap between democratic rhetoric versus democratic reality. And whether the President of the United States or conservatives or critics believe it or not, African Americans are citizens who built this democracy and are going to refuse to stop talking about race until this democracy recognizes their citizenship fully and wholly.
Let's hear from Olaf in Houston. Olaf, go ahead, please.
Hello. I just wanted to share a personal story of mine. So I'm a black professional in my early 30s, and I work in the senior management of my company. And a couple of years ago, I was working late, and a security guard walked up to the executive floor and saw me there and pulled a gun on me because he didn't think it made sense for a black man to be on the executive floor late at night. And even though, you know, I was not harmed or anything, like, you know, it's just like, you know, it characterizes what black people deal with all the time. It's not necessarily dependent on how rich you are or how poor you are. You will be profiled because I was wearing a suit. I wasn't wearing a hoodie. And he still pulled a gun on me because he thought I was in the wrong place because I was black and I didn't deserve to be on the executive floor. So, you know, it just happens to us every day. And a lot of people just don't recognize it.
Olaf, thank you.
There's
thank
a great you. T-shirt that responds to this tired comment. It says, I'm tired. I've been black all day. So that's kind of how we feel about it.
And you also said, Eva, before our program started, that you felt a level of anger that you don't typically feel.
I felt enraged. After I heard the verdict, I was walking around in Berkeley, and every white person I saw, I was mad at. Now, that was irrational, but I felt like, how could you white people let this happen? Now, the people out there who are tired of this conversation, I'm sure, are just turning off the radio right now and doing something else. But it was something I haven't felt since the Black Power movement and the days of the late 1960s. I was just enraged. And the people who are calling saying that they're tired of this, it's like, come on. So I've I wrote a little op-ed about this, and a number of black people wrote back to me and said, I felt angry as well. I was really surprised. I felt kind of aberrant about this, but a lot of us felt enraged.
So here's my last question to each of you. Just give me 30 seconds each on what you'd like people to do when this program is over who are tired.
I would like for people, all of us, no matter race, income, whatever your status, all of them, to understand that we are in this together. This is not someone else's problem. That as a nation, we will not live up to our democratic ideals, our economic potential, or our aspirations as a nation if we don't figure out how to create a society in which all can participate and prosper. It's always been the moral thing to do. But as we become a nation in which the majority will be people of color, and as we see so many people of color being left behind, this agenda of participating, prospering, and reaching your full potential becomes an economic and a national imperative.
Peniel Joseph, 30 seconds for those who are tired.
Well, I say for those who are tired but interested in continuing the dialogue and having that conversation, I think that they should reach out to all these listeners, all these speakers today, rather. Follow us on Twitter. I've mentioned the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. Find out what we're doing. We're part of leading that national conversation. We have a sister center at Arizona State University. I think that the most imperative thing right now is to educate ourselves about inequality, an inequality that is connected to not just racial inequality, but economic inequality, inequality that's connected to gender, that's connected to sexuality, because this is part of the crisis of American democracy right now. We are becoming a multicultural and multiracial democracy, but we're facing a backlash, a counter-revolution against forces that want the United States to be a different kind of country, a different kind of democracy.
And we have to hold, I'm sorry, we do have to hold you there so I can give Eva 10 seconds.
Give us the benefit of the doubt. We'd rather be out having brunch with each other, talking about our kids and the movies we want to see. We don't want to be here this morning talking about a young boy being shot and murdered. Give us the benefit of the doubt. There's a problem. We're all in this together.
Eva Patterson, Angela Glover Blackwell, Peniel Joseph, thanks all very much. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.